NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
MSW Media.
They Might Be Giants have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And They Might Be Giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now They Might Be Giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one. This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
Law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
All right, welcome to episode 10 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. We have an unbelievable interview coming up. Please don't just fast forward to that part, though. Like, anyway, I'm Andrew Torres, and with me, excited beyond words.
Yes, and I'm AG. And before we get to the A block, and the announcement of our incredible interview, I want to thank our newest patrons, Patricia Carrasco, Dan Beniger, Potato Face, Taryn Powell, Three Kobolds in a Trench Coat, Skylar Verastecki. I unsubscribed from some Fox Titties for you, Maxwell Skipworth, and Spaceball One. They've gone to Plaid.
Some fantastic names. Thanks also to new patrons Nicole Heil, Susan Harold, Steph DeMonico, Jason and Elizabeth McQueen. I promise I didn't just give you all the fun ones. This is just how it broke down. Mm-hmm. FNB997, Tom Dunn, Taylor Losher, and Scoop Bucky.
Scoop Bucky is pretty good. It's no, I unsubscribed from some Fox Titties for you, but it's good.
It is. Connection all the way over to our good friends at Ice Cream Social. So thanks to all of you for supporting the show, which you can do over at patreon.com/aisle45pod for as little as a buck an episode. And if we may tempt you, if you can pony up two American dollars, that's it, you get the chance to play bar trivia against me and AG over Zoom. Bunch of groups have already formed. There's some smack talk already developing on the Patreon thread. So get in. You can be a team of up to five, and it's just gonna be me and AG by ourselves. I mean, you know, we're obviously still gonna win, but
Yeah, and you can also pick your team name, which you need to do, and that it's kind of all rests with the team name. My championship pub trivia team was Team Awesome. I was also part of a team called Kick Astley instead of Rick Astley.
Yeah. I like that. A little Rick rolling there for us. That's good.
Yes, and now we're going to have to find a segue from Rick rolling to sedition, and I'm not sure how to make that happen, but how about just... Here's a segue into sedition from Rick Astley. So, the former guy's former interim U.S. attorney for D.C., Michael Sherwin, went on 60 Minutes and said that he thinks charges of seditious conspiracy could be brought against certain defendants in the January 6th insurrection. And during the interview, Sherwin said, "I personally believe the evidence is trending toward that and possibly meets those elements." So, what does that mean, Andrew?
Yeah. So, seditious conspiracy is 18 U.S.C. section 2384, and I'm going to elide over the parts that don't matter, but it says, if two or more persons conspire to overthrow the government of the United States, right, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States.
That sounds very important in this particular situation.
Yeah, or, and again, these are all disjunctive, by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States contrary to the authority thereof, they shall each be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both.
Ah.
And so it is fair to say this is a rarely charged statute. But that's not because there's some inherent defect in this law. It's because people rarely do the kinds of things that seem to meet like the plain text of this statute. It does not require, I mean, you know, conspire is something that courts are, you know, that the prosecutors are very well trained to prove and juries adjudicate every single day. And you just need to conspire to do one of those three things: overthrow the government, hinder, prevent, or delay the execution of any law, or seize, take, possess any property by force.
Now, you mentioned that those are disjunctive, or not and. And I think that that's really important. But I do have a question for you, like legal practical application here, because I think the last time we saw a sedition charge was in 2010 with a Michigan militia, and the judge found that they did not prove that there was a hardcore conspiracy going on. As a prosecutor, do you have to say which element of this statute you are filing the charges under? Like, for example, do you have to say that we're filing sedition charges specifically about the force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States part? Or can you just say, I've read a lot of charging documents, and you usually go through and say how these crimes were committed, right, and what part they fit under. But I mean, can you just say we're doing it under the whole thing, and you pick which of the three, or do you have to kind of be more specific?
No. So in the charging documents, and again, until you get a jury instruction at the end of trial, you do not have to pick. And part of the reason for that is everything I read to you is all part of 2384. There are no subparts. There's no A, B, C, or D. There are no consecutive sections. So sometimes when you see related offenses, it's because, you know, you could be charged with a 1001A or a 1001B, right? And they will specify, oh, this is subsection B. All of those were in the same basic section. So you charge 2384, and then we figure out at trial exactly what meets what particular criterion. You are correct about the last time seditious conspiracy, as far as I can tell, went to trial. And again, it is because as we go through some of these other earlier cases, right, you don't have people storming and occupying the Capitol, right?
Right.
So, I am not convinced that this is reaching. So.
Yeah, especially the any law of the United States part, right?
Yep. Yep.
and that certification of the election results is a law.
Yeah.
And the problem here, I don't trust Mike Sherwin.
I don't either. I think you're right to do that. But look, like, if this were Blank Boxman that gave that 60 Minutes interview, you'd be thrilled, right? Because Sherwin not only said, I think charges of seditious conspiracy are appropriate here, he said that he personally witnessed some of the events, right? Noticing people in Kevlar vests, helmets, tactical gear leave early while he accompanied the DC police to the former guy's rally. I do not know why this was cut from the interview, but apparently 60 Minutes reported that he debunked claims about Antifa posing as Trump supporters, and went on to discuss, you know, whether folks who received a tour of the Capitol grounds before January 6th were, quote, casing or doing reconnaissance runs. So, like, those are all the kinds of things that you would want the lead prosecutor to say. So,
yeah. And this isn't the first time Sherwin has said this, right? Back on January 26th, he told the Washington Post, we're closely looking at evidence related to sedition charges. So that's why this didn't seem like major breaking news to me. And he said, we're working on those cases. I think the results will bear fruit very soon. And in the B block, we're going to talk with someone who thinks his talking about it publicly is a mistake.
Yeah. And I am so excited for that. But look, as a lawyer analyzing this, right, I think Sherwin's correct, right? I read you the statute. This is not like the old Alien and Sedition Acts, right, where you're punishing speech. What you're punishing here is action. You are punishing serious crimes. And it's true that it's rarely invoked, like you said, but I think we had a closer fit in 1987, the Fort Smith sedition trial, right, where a bunch of white supremacists who wanted to overthrow the government and establish an all-white nation were indicted and they were charged with seditious conspiracy.
Okay, but weren't the Fort Smith defendants acquitted?
Fair. but look, that's because that's really for two reasons. Number one, the case was nowhere near as well developed as this, right? Like the actions in furtherance of the conspiracy were things like, were ancillary crimes setting up to the long-term goal of overthrowing the government, not occupying the Capitol, right? So that's kind of point one. And then point two, the prosecution cut a deal with the leader of the actual group itself. It was like the Order of the Cross and some kind of crazy ass, you know, white supremacist group. A guy named Jim Ellison, after Jim Ellison got 20 years on RICO, right? And then he said, okay, so can you come in and testify against everybody else? And Ellison said, well, can I get some cooperation credits? And they said, sure, fine. And look, when you have the head guy testifying against the underlings, that often doesn't look great to a jury.
Yeah, no. And, you know, we've heard talk in public reporting that they're looking at overarching RICO charges here. And we have reporting from the Washington Post today saying that they're getting ready to start offering plea deals to a lot of the insurrectionists. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, a grand jury did hand those indictments down.
Yep.
in the Fort Smith case. So at least they made a determination that probable cause existed to convict based on the facts, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And I think we're going to see that here. I think that is a really perceptive question about who you plead out, right? In terms of in connection with the January 6th insurrection, because we're looking at 300, 400 potential defendants. And, you know, you can't try 400 people. So that might be a question I ask in the next segment.
Yeah. And like the Fort Smith trial, prosecutors with the U.S. Attorney's Office for D.C., they've charged about 20 members or so of the Proud Boys, as well as other alt-right neo-Nazi groups. And on Friday, prosecutors unsealed the latest indictment. They charged four Proud Boys leaders from Washington State, Florida, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania with conspiracy to aid and abet the obstruction of Congress's confirmation of the 2020 presidential election and police attempts to protect the Capitol from rioting that led to five deaths and 130 or so police assaults.
Yeah. And so there's your specificity in those particular indictments. That suggests that they do not have belief in or sufficient evidence at this point in the larger notion of overthrowing the U.S. government. You got to pick your battles. But I want to kind of go back to something you said a couple of episodes ago that we've just commented that this is something that was incredibly well done during the second impeachment, right, by the House managers. And that is drawing the lines between the alt-right foot soldiers and trying to figure out, right, who did the coordination, who did the funding, who was behind it. So in addition to the Proud Boys, we've got prosecutors have accused 10 members and affiliates of the Oath Keepers with conspiring to obstruct Congress. And I have to tell you, I knew the Proud Boys were, you know, because our president shouted them out on national television. But I didn't know the Oath Keepers until the second impeachment. So,
Yeah. And as of right now, as we're recording this, members or associates of those two groups make up about 10% of more than 300 charged so far. Prosecutors have said they expect at least 400 people to be charged. And federal law makes conspiring to overthrow or oppose by force federal authority punishable by up to 20 years in prison. That's big. And these aren't we started out with those smaller crimes, violent entry and trespassing, et cetera. But now, you know, they're adding and superseding with these conspiracy and sedition, potential sedition charges. But that's up to 20 years in prison, including the use of violence to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law in the United States law.
Yep. So with respect to your guy, Sherwin, right, he stepped down as acting U.S. attorney for D.C. on March 3rd. That allowed the Biden administration to rename Channing Phillips as the acting U.S. attorney while the White House and Attorney General Merrick Garland select a permanent nominee. This is obviously going to be a very important high profile selection. So Sherwin, as far as I can tell, has been asked by Merrick Garland to stay in D.C. for another month to transition these cases over to the new nominee. And then Sherwin will go rejoin the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida.
Yeah, he did ask him that on March 3rd, and he stayed, and apparently Friday was his last day, and I think this weekend he headed down to Miami.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, got it done in 3 weeks, so.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. I still don't trust him.
You're not wrong.
Now, we have not told the listeners who our interview is.
Oh, gosh.
It's going to be in the title. They already know they've read the title.
They do know, that's right.
And we're really excited to talk to him. Andrew Weissman, he's author of the book Where Law Ends Inside the Mueller Investigation. He was one of the top, he was team leader for Team Manafort in the Mueller investigation. And we're going to speak with him about these sedition charges, what he thinks of Sherwin appearing on television, and just, you know, what the frick is going on in general. So we're looking forward to that.
Can't wait.
Yep. Everybody stick around. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's AG for Cleanup on Aisle 45. Do you ever listen to the podcast, you hear Andrew and I talking, and you want to scream your opinions at us? Well, now you can. We go live on the Stereo app every Tuesday at 5 Pacific, 8 Eastern, where you can ask us your questions directly. Join us for the Cleanup on Aisle 45 after-party Q&A for uncensored opinions. You might even hear Andrew say fuck. And exclusive content, only available on the Stereo app. I love Stereo. I'm on the app talking all the time. You can follow me at Allison Gill. You'll get notified every time I go live. And you can follow Andrew at Torres, and we'll take a deep dive into a variety of topics and interact directly with listeners. So download the Stereo app now. You can do that by going to stereo.com/AllisonGill. Set up a little avatar. It's super fun. There's a link in the show description. And then join us on the Stereo app. Stereo has thousands of live social conversations from a wide range of topics, including news, comedy, sports, everything you want. So you can choose whether to be a co-host, participate as a guest, or just listen in on exclusive conversations. So we'll see you for the Cleanup on Aisle 45 after party Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 Eastern. All right, everybody, welcome back. We are honored and privileged today to be joined by 20-year DOJ veteran, lead prosecutor inside the Mueller investigation, and author of the New York Times bestseller, Where Law Ends Inside the Mueller Investigation. Please welcome Andrew Weissman. Andrew, hi.
Hi, nice to be here.
It is really great to have you.
Okay, I want to echo that. Big question that is on everyone's minds right now. Outgoing acting U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, Mike Sherwin, has commented multiple times publicly that some of the defendants who have been charged in the 1/6 Capitol riots are likely or the facts fit the definition of being charged with seditious conspiracy. And you've publicly said that that this is a mistake. And so I wanted to have you on to discuss that.
Well, I think you don't have to be a 20-year veteran at the Department of Justice to know that what he did, not just on 60 Minutes, but also when he, in a press conference, was just talking about his personal views of the, these are my terms, the outrageous conduct on January 6th. Those statements are not ones that you make as a Department of Justice employee. There are really strict rules about not commenting on ongoing investigations. You're not supposed to comment on your personal views of the facts up to and including through a defendant being found guilty. In other words, even upon a charging of a defendant, you don't say, we charge this person and let me just tell you about all the great proof we have and why the person's guilty. And the reason for that is to assure a fair trial for the defendant. And certainly, if there's an ongoing investigation, those people may or may not be charged, and you don't disparage them. One of the things that we may all remember is the outrage at Jim Comey in July of a campaign year, commenting on the ending of an investigation involving Hillary Clinton. That falls into the same category. You don't give those public pronouncements. And part of it is, it's not your job. It's a grand jury's job to either indict or not indict. And within the department, we generally describe this as either put up or shut up. So I think a lot of us were just really flabbergasted by Sherwin's comments.
Let me drill down on that for just one second, which is, would the prohibition that you've just described, would that cover? So in other words, suppose I asked you on this show, do you think a superseding indictment is likely, right? And you know that it's imminent, right? Would that cover, go so far as to say that, you know, you would give me a no comment on that?
So first of all, it wouldn't cover me, a private citizen, but let's assume that you for some reason had a current DOJ person on a podcast, which, you know, itself would be odd. But they're not going to comment on what is or is not likely to happen in a case. Where that could come up is in court. A judge may say, you know, I want to set a trial date. As a prosecutor or a defense lawyer may talk about whether there are likely to be other charges, meaning it's too soon to set a trial date because the investigation may expand and change things. But that would be the forum in which to raise it, even if you thought it was imminent. And, you know, this is to me sort of the flip side of, you know, people commented about how tight-lipped Robert Mueller was during the special counsel investigation. And I think all of us were particularly proud of the sort of no-leak reputation we had of just doing our job. And this is really the flip side, which is trying your case in the press. And one of the reasons of many that you shouldn't do that is in D.C., there is a local rule that the courts put out that it's essentially a form of a gag order to assure a fair trial for both sides by not having the defense be able to speak and disparage the prosecution and vice versa. You may famously remember a lot of issues coming up about those rules in the Manafort case and in the Roger Stone case. You know, as somebody who is in the department, I find it particularly egregious when it's coming from people in the department. And for Michael Sherwin, this is such a blatant violation. To me, it'll be very interesting to see, since he is a current DOJ employee, although no longer the acting U.S. attorney, whether there are sanctions for this, because it typically is the kind of thing that people can find their, you know, careers damaged by this kind of conduct.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was wondering, because CNN is now reporting that he did skirt getting permission from the Department of Justice to go on 60 Minutes and give this interview. So I was kind of wondering what those sanctions look like, but also mechanically how this would come up in a prosecution. Would it come up in jury selection and voir dire when you're, you know, trying to, you know, figure out, or if somebody puts in a motion to change venue, or perhaps after conviction on appeal, would it give an appeal some more juice? And so maybe you could go over like how this technically could impact negatively an investigation.
Yeah, those are all great questions. So first, within DOJ, there is an arm of the department that looks at attorney violations as well as FBI violations, the FBI being a part of the Department of Justice. And there have been those kinds of sanctions when there have been these kinds of statements made by prosecutors or agents, usually inadvertently. Here, there's a pattern because this isn't just a one-off. And so it's hard to see that they wouldn't take action here in order to set an example. And I'm not surprised that he didn't ask for permission, because there's no way in God's green earth that he would have gotten it. Your second question, which is really a terrific one, is sort of how this would play out in the courts. So one is the court itself could take this up. There is a chief judge of the United States District Court, fabulous judge named Beryl Howell. She could take it up because it's a violation of the local rules. A defense lawyer can raise it for the same reason and say, judge, that this should be taken up by the court because it's a violation. And the court can refer it for investigation and for disciplinary action. And then the defendant certainly can raise this in terms of pretrial publicity and wanting to have, for instance, a questionnaire to make sure that the jurors have not been influenced by it. I think more importantly, if I was on the defense side of this, I would use it to try and say there should be a change of venue. I'm not sure that would fly, but you can imagine there already is a relatively strong argument for a change of venue, given that the attack happened in D.C. and people in D.C. were incredibly aware of it. So we're not quite in the same situation that we once had in Enron, where they asked for a change of venue and the judges there said, where in the country do you plan on going, where they haven't heard about this case? And the remedy for making sure that you weed out people with prejudices that they can't put aside is to have a really detailed voir dire, which, you know, since it was in the South, that you learned to say voir dire. So that's the other way that a defense lawyer would use this.
Okay. That's really, I think that's really interesting because, you know, we had all, I think all of us had tweeted, I can't believe he's talking about this case again, before we had heard that he had not gotten permission. And then we all sort of went, well, of course he didn't get permission because he wouldn't have gotten permission. Now, he is an assistant U.S. attorney in Florida. Is that right? Before he was pulled up to go do. And we have a kind of a history, and you have kind of a history, or at least your work has kind of a history with Mike Sherwin. And I kind of wanted to detail that because we left that out of the earlier part of the show. And I was just wondering sort of prior to this, Andrew, what your thoughts on Mr. Sherwin are, considering what he had done and made suggestions with a lot of the work that your office did in the Mueller investigation.
So, you know, we didn't overlap at all. So I didn't know him. I don't know that I've ever even met him. To my mind, my biggest concerns are not issues related to the special counsel investigation. It really is more about the way he's handled the January 6th investigations. I've been very critical of the department, including the FBI, which I love and worked at and think they're wonderful people there. But I think it's very hard to look at the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security and say that their finest moment was January 6th. I mean, it clearly was a huge error. And not to get on my soapbox, but the difference in the disparate treatment of the way in which the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI handled the protests here in New York City, for instance, in May of last year, when there were Black Lives Matter protests, and people who, there were two young people of color who were alleged to have thrown Molotov cocktails at an empty car, a police car. A terrible thing if that they did, but there wasn't the immediate loss of life or even the real risk of that. They were arrested the same day by law enforcement, and that was on a Saturday. And that day they were arrested and thrown in jail, and the government sought remand consistently in the magistrate court, district court, court of appeals, and threw the book at them. And that all happened on the same day on a Saturday. And when you compare that to how the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security reacted on January 6th, it's really hard to think that that is what is equal law enforcement. And as many times as Sherwin would be in the press and giving press conferences inappropriately, describing his views of what's going on, to me, that was almost an exhibit to the problem, because you shouldn't have to be asking the public for help identifying people who were committing the crime that was anticipated and right in front of you. To me, that was, of course, now it's like, you know, once the horse is out of the barn, that's all you can do. But it should have been done with a lot more humility in terms of the screw up that had happened in not being on top of their game at the time. Now, the one thing I would say is that I do think that there is a role for educating the public. But here, the line that was crossed was making sure that you are not talking about the evidence against individual people. You're not giving your personal views. But if you're giving a discussion to the public about what in general is being done to investigate and alerting people to how seriously you're taking it, or dealing with the issue of how you're going to address disparate treatment of people of color and white people and what you're doing to remedy that, all of that I do think is an important educational function. And what's a shame here is that that got tied up in, you know, Sherwin's not adhering to basic due process rules embedded in the Department of Justice and the District of Columbia local court rules.
I think your point on the disparate treatment is really, really well taken. And one of the things that we've commented on is that much of, well, I was going to say much of the first wave of indictments, but that's actually an understatement. The supermajority of indictments that have come down so far have been on relatively minor, right, criminal misdemeanors and other
violent entry, trespassing, yeah, et cetera.
Exactly. And so do you anticipate that there's going to be a large wave of superseding indictments in these cases? Or I guess that kind of ties into the larger question of,
well, Sherwin told you, we've met the bar for evidence and sedition. We've got conspiracy on the Oath Keepers, and we're still looking at Donald Trump, too. And, oh, and we could have a murder charge if the ME comes back, you know, with the bear spray in connection with the death of officer. I mean, he gave us so much detail, and it was just absolutely stunning.
Yeah, and that's one where, you know, I don't know what will happen. That's the, and I have to say, I've just not been impressed with the way this has been handled. The one thing I would say is that the FBI, having been part of the problem, at least is not playing to the media. They are just keeping their heads down, and you don't see them participating in these kinds of press conferences and talking about what, you know, all the things that they anticipate happening, as it should be. And they you don't get credit for doing the right thing. It's just worth noting that they're not part of what Sherwin's doing. It's also particularly inappropriate for somebody who's no longer on the investigation to now be commenting on it. And as Allison pointed out, in ways that really undermine the prosecution. You are feeding information into the public that's going to be used by the defense, as they should. I mean, the defense is entitled to, you know, make any and all arguments based on it. So where this will go, I don't know. It doesn't right now seem like this is the most coordinated investigation. There have been some embarrassing things that have happened in court, and you don't sense that there is what I'll call a sort of Bob Mueller approach, which is everything is buttoned down and meticulous. And, you know, he, along with a lot of other people, held you to an extremely high standard, and things are, you know, really done in the highest and best tradition of the department. And that this doesn't feel like that, at least at this stage. The one thing I will say is the new interim U.S. attorney is terrific.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Yeah, because I think that's really important too, because we're waiting for a whole bunch of new U.S. attorneys. And, you know, I imagine that the Department of Justice, after in a transition, has already got some vulnerabilities, and then particularly after the 4 years of the previous administration. And I was wondering also your thoughts on this back and forth with Republicans and Democrats on an insurrection commission, that the Republicans want to include an investigation into Black Lives Matter protests and Antifa violence, and the Democrats aren't budging on that, and I'm glad. But Pelosi says, well, we'll just do it in the Congress. And I was thinking, for a commission style investigation, I'm wondering if Merrick Garland wouldn't appoint a special counsel and a team like the Mueller investigation to look into this to get the answers. It seems like it would fare a lot better than Jim Jordan in his rolled up shirt sleeves, you know, yelling at people on the television.
Well, I think there's sort of a lot to unpack there. So first, within the department, I agree that the department could do, in many ways, you know, potentially a better job of sort of examining what happened. I don't think you would need a special counsel, because I don't think it's so political that Merrick Garland needs to recuse himself, or there's some concern about his objectivity in overseeing that kind of investigation. It's not like there's an investigation into the president, who appointed him. So, I don't think you would need a special counsel. This also is an area where the inspectors general could do an investigation, because there are issues about how, as we talked about, the Department of Justice, including the FBI and the IG for the Department of Homeland Security, you know, that could be investigated by the IGs. With respect to a congressional investigation, unfortunately, you know, I don't think anybody has high hopes for how that will go in terms of developing information as opposed to politicizing the issue. And so I understand the reason to want an investigation. It's really way out of my bailiwick in terms of my expertise, and you know, I would hope... I have an ideal for what a congressional investigation could look like, but I unfortunately am cynical enough to think that it's not going to come close to that. So I'm not sure what will be accomplished by having that kind of investigation, as much as there are things to look at.
I see. So, because I was saying, you know, this needs to be apolitical, and you're saying no need for a special counsel. Merrick Garland can do it apolitically.
Yeah. And as could inspectors general. And you know, inspectors general are good. They have some things to answer for, but in terms of not being, I would say, bold during the last 4 years in looking at various issues, but now they know that they can look at these issues, and there's certainly a lot to look at for the department and for the Department of Homeland Security in terms of how they handled this.
Yeah, I could ask you, I think, another hour's worth of questions, but I want to talk about coordination on 400 individual defendants. I mean, so much that's out there, but I think I'd like to leave you with this one. How does it feel to be on on the other side of the table now and commenting on investigations rather than being the subject of podcasts like these.
Right, and speaking to the person who hosted the number Premier one, yeah. Mueller, she wrote podcast for 2.5 years.
Yeah. So, you know, it's both good and bad. I really like the process of translating what's going on and using whatever expertise I have to try and give insight. That's the fun, good part. And it's also freeing in the sense that, you know, unlike Sherwin, when you're in the department, you don't do this and you don't speak about it. So it's kind of a nice new thing to be able to do. The bad part is, you know, being on the outside where you really want to know what's happening and what the real reasons are. So that, I think it's very much, I'm sure a lot of people are like, see, it's not so easy.
Yeah. Welcome. Yeah. Well, this has been really, really awesome. I really recommend everybody check out your book, which Thank I you. Absolutely love. I chewed it up in a weekend. It's called Where Law Ends Inside the Mueller Investigation. There's a lot of really, really interesting stuff in there that we didn't get in the public reporting when the Mueller investigation was happening. But I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Andrew Weissman.
Thanks for having me.
Everybody stick around. We'll be right back after this break. Hey, everybody. It's AG for Cleanup on Aisle 45. Spring has sprung. It's time for spring cleaning and getting your house in order. You can get a head start by revisiting your home and auto insurance with Policy Genius. Policy Genius can help you set two birds free with one key. You can compare home and auto insurance rates, and you can save up to $1,055 per year by reshopping. That is money you can put towards things you really care about. For me, that's like wine and traveling. Maybe some toys for my gatos. But first, you have to head to PolicyGenius.com, answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then Policy Genius will take it from there. They compare rates for over 30 top insurers, from Progressive to Nationwide, to find you the lowest quotes. The Policy Genius team will look at all the ways to maximize your savings, too, including bundling your home and auto, for example. If Policy Genius finds a better rate than what you're paying now, they'll switch you over for free. They do all the heavy lifting. It's no wonder with that level of service, Policy Genius has earned a 5-star rating across over 1,600 reviews on Trustpilot and Google. If you're worried that this year is flying by and you've barely gotten anything done, it's cool. Take a deep breath. Policy Genius will help you make the most of this month in minutes. Just reshop your home and auto insurance, and you could save up to $1,055. Head to PolicyGenius.com to get started right now. That's Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. Everybody, welcome back. What an absolute honor to speak with him. Just an incredible prosecutor who's done an amazing job for this country. It was really, really wonderful to speak to him.
Yeah, we could have gone 20 more minutes, 20 more hours, a week and a half. Mm-hmm. Ugh.
I know, I had a whole podcast about the Mueller investigation. Yeah,
did you? Yeah. I think I heard about that.
This next story I wanted to tell everybody about, it flew completely under the radar, but it's essential in holding the Trump administration accountable for past actions. As it stands, inspectors general only have subpoena power for current government officials. That makes it difficult to look into the actions of the past administration, right? Because of all of our comings and goings, particularly the goings, bye-bye, they're no longer federal officials. Well, Congressman Jimmy Gomez, California's 34th District, Vice Chair of the Committee on Oversight and Reform, along with Committee Chairwoman Carolyn B. Maloney and Subcommittee on Government Operations Chairman Gerald Connolly, introduced the IG Subpoena Authority Act to grant testimonial subpoena authority to federal inspectors general. Now, there's something very specific about this, right?
Yeah. Gomez said of the IG Subpoena Authority Act, quote, "Full and complete investigations are among the most effective tools our country has in securing transparency and holding government accountable. So by giving inspectors general the ability to compel testimony from contractors and former employees, the IG Subpoena Authority Act strongly reflects our committee's ongoing commitment to addressing corruption and injustice nationwide." That is Section 6A of the new act.
Yes. And he continued saying, by saying former government officials and other parties with information that could help an investigation should not be able to hide from their responsibility to cooperate with an inspector general. At a time when multiple former officials have refused to comply with inspector general investigations, this bill would grant the government's independent watchdogs a critical tool to ensure transparency and accountability. So, Andrew, what's interesting is what prompted this push for new legislation.
Yeah, so as it turns out, the Department of Justice Inspector General told the committee during testimony last month that under the status quo, Jeff Sessions could avoid questions from investigators about his role in separating children at the border because he's no longer a federal official. And Chairman Connolly said, inspectors general need testimonial subpoena authority to hold former officials accountable for their actions and the consequences of their policy decisions. We cannot allow individuals to escape accountability or hide critical information simply by leaving federal service.
Yeah. And this bill would grant the inspectors general subpoena authority to compel testimony from individuals other than current federal employees. It also includes procedural safeguards, because under the bill, a testimonial subpoena would have to be approved by a special panel of the Council of Inspectors General of Integrity and Efficiency. That's the CIGIE. If approved, notice would be given to the Attorney General, who would have 10 days to object to its issuance if he or she determined that it would interfere with an ongoing investigation. And of course, because you're you and I'm me, we cannot help but think about this from the other side, right? When we win a massive election and then generally in the midterm following, we lose control of certain houses and certain things, it's important to note that this could turn around the other way. However, yep. I mean, you know, how have their investigations gone of former things in Congress? Let's look at Benghazi and the email stuff. Like nothing comes of these. You know, this is going to heavily benefit Democrats because Republicans crime way more.
Yeah,
often.
And look, it was a joke that Hillary Clinton had to sit for those 19 hours of Benghazi inquiries. But she did. Mm-hmm. Right. And I suspect, well, I don't think you have to suspect. You can look at her Twitter feed, right? She's willing to take that trade off of, okay, I get it. Republicans are going to abuse the rules. I'm willing to take that trade off to have the rules in place so that mm-hmm. we can stop kind of actual crimes.
Yeah, I'm willing to do that as well. But I do have a question for you, Andrew. I assume this authority would extend well beyond the racist possum, Jeff Sessions. And it would allow for subpoena power over any former federal officer that would come up in an investigation. But could former officials simply refuse to comply with a subpoena, as we saw time and again during the former guy's administration, which would languish in court for years? Is that a possibility here?
So let me break down both halves of that question, right? The first is, here's what the bill specifically does. This is section 6A, page 2, line 4. It says, in addition to the authority otherwise provided by the act, right, that is to subpoena current officials, the inspector general is authorized to require by subpoena the attendance and testimony of witnesses as necessary in the performance of the functions assigned to the inspector general by this act, or in the case of an inspector general or special inspector general not established under this act, the functions assigned by the authorizing statute. So what that does is lifts the requirements, you know, the sort of narrow requirements that are currently in existence. So yes, it would extend well beyond Jeff Sessions to any witnesses that are necessary for the performance of the function of the inspector general. Now, how is this going to hit the courts? Two ways. The first is the other guy's lackeys asserted vicariously a claim of executive privilege. That's why we had all of the Don McGahn litigation and everything else that produced some of the, you know, truly inexplicable holdings, you know, that then the entire U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit had to get together and reverse that bizarre 2-1 panel decision. Naomi Rao, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
But all of those assertions were based upon executive privilege. They were incorrect. But those assertions no longer exist as a present assertion, right? They now have to be evaluated, right? Because they have nothing privileged for the current president of the United States.
So right? You can't claim executive privilege if you're no longer an executive federal employee. You can't claim executive privilege on past communications.
You can claim it on a case-by-case basis where that communication relates to, right?
Well, that's how you're supposed to claim it now.
Exactly.
So that's
right.
That's why I'm saying, yeah. Couldn't
no,
they
no,
just
no.
say the same
you're
shit?
You're right. You're right to be to be confused about it because the arguments were terrible. And I was surprised. I mean, it was one of the biggest miscalls.
Well, I'm not confused about it. I know what they did. I'm just saying it seems like they could do it again. Like they could claim executive privilege in the past, which is still a bad argument. It was a bad argument when it was in the present. But I don't think that whether they're current federal officers or former federal officers has any impact on an absolutely ignorant, ridiculous, stupid claim like executive privilege, because they're all supposed to be decided on a case-by-case basis.
And I think it does, because a present assertion of executive... Well, here's why, right? A present assertion of executive privilege invokes two unique public policy considerations. The first is the testimonial need for the president to have candid advice from his or her officials, right?
Right.
And that exists whether you are currently the president or not. But the second, and what carried the day, for example, in the Naomi Rao opinion, was a separation of powers argument, was an idea that, right, this is a dispute between the legislature and the president, and you as the court shouldn't get involved in that, right? That makes it I see you like it. It's a bizarre argument.
But now we've blown up the separation of powers issue.
Yeah. There is no it's current moot. Harm to the president. That's right.
All right.
So cool. I don't think that they will be able to get away with it. Again, I didn't think they would have been able to get away with it in the past. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. But
they'll fight it, but they don't have the separation of powers argument. That's the
exactly
one
right.
thing that was granted in that whole shit show.
Yeah. And look, it is clear executive privilege is not absolute. Yeah, you're 100% right. You're 100% correct in wanting to be skeptical. But ever the optimist, I think that it does make a difference.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I had forgotten about Rao's separation of power idiocy, and that makes me feel much better about all of this.
Yeah.
So,
This will get challenged, right? If this becomes law, then what Republicans will do is go to a U.S. district court and argue that this is ultra vires, that this is beyond the power of Congress to amend in terms of delegating powers to inspectors general. That's not a great argument because Congress has the power to begin with, right? So, you know, this would be an additional delegation by Congress. But that's also how I expect that they will tee this up, is to say, oh, no. Like this completely transforms the earlier Inspector General Act of 1952. We will see and evaluate that argument, but I don't weight it particularly highly.
Yeah. And here's the other obstacle. Even before any of this law gets enacted, you have to pass it. And I can't think of 10 Republicans. You're going to run up against a filibuster. I cannot think of 10 Republicans who haven't committed crimes. So I don't see this getting passed. I don't see this getting passed. I just don't see getting out of the Senate.
I hear you. And what I will say is, you know, what I've been saying since episode one, which is, you and I and everybody who listens to the show need no convincing on blowing up the filibuster, right?
Right.
But 80 million people do, right? These are people who are pro-Democratic, who voted Joe Biden, who want to see Joe Biden be able to have a shot at governing, but they don't understand the mechanics of the filibuster. And what you see the Biden administration and his allies in the Senate doing is building the case, right? And in order to build the case, you've got to take a couple losses, right? Like you've got to take your lumps so that you can go to the American public and go, look, we're trying here, but the Republicans are blocking everything.
So I think the step one of bringing back the talking filibuster, this isn't just to bring back the talking filibuster. It's to take steps down the road to get rid of the filibuster, potentially. And it's also to raise awareness to the American public of what the frick the filibuster is in the first place, right?
Possibly I was setting you up to promote your tweets about gutting the filibuster, which were rather spectacular. So,
thank you. Yeah. From the old Saturday Night Live, Dick in a Box. Step one, cut a hole in the filibuster. Step two, make DC a state. Step three, kill the filibuster. And that's the way you do it.
And that's the way you do it.
Complete with pictures and GIFs. And it was a play in three acts on how to get rid of the filibuster. And we did have today in the Oversight Committee first hearing. Today, March 22nd, as we record this, the first hearing for DC statehood. And so it's got a lot of support, and I'm excited to see where it goes and how they implement the talking filibuster, which they will need to do before they try to make DC a state.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is another strong sign is the arguments on display in opposition to DC statehood were embarrassingly bad.
Oh, did you see the yard signs guy?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Oh, this was amazing. He basically said, look, they have representation. I can tell because they put signs in their yard when I drive to work. So that is what the Heritage Foundation guy said. He said they have representation because they are allowed to put yard signs up for their political candidate of choice in their yard. That is what taxation with representation means, is that you get to put up yard signs, you don't need a vote.
That's from the Heritage Foundation. Good that he's at a think tank. I'm impressed, but
yeah, and he had Chuck Todd bangs too. So I immediately can't take anything that he says seriously. All right, we've got another great block of news coming up. We do have to take a quick break, so stick around. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's AG, and this segment of Cleanup on Aisle 45 is brought to you by Magic Spoon. It is so amazing, a cereal so delicious you will not believe it's good for you. I've been a huge cereal fan since I was a kid. I would sit down in front of Saturday morning cartoons and eat some just, like, probably a whole box of cereal, and then drink the delicious milk after. But as an adult, I had to give it up because of all the chemical sugar and carbs. But not anymore with Magic Spoon. As Forbes magazine says, with cereal that tastes this good and offers so much nutritional value, as opposed to, well, none, Magic Spoon may be the future of breakfast. Magic Spoon cereals have amazingly zero sugar, 12 grams of protein, and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. It is keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, high-protein, and GMO-free. And the best part? It's super delicious. They have 4 amazing flavors, super vintage style. They have cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry. It tastes so incredible. It seems too good to be true, but it's not. My favorite flavor right now is cocoa. I eat it, and then I drink to chocolatey milk. I can have it as a snack or a dessert. It's so healthy, it's guilt-free, and I love it. So go to magicspoon.com/cleanup. You can grab a variety pack and try all 4 flavors today. And be sure to use our promo code cleanup at checkout to get free shipping. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/cleanup and use code cleanup for free shipping. And we thank Magic Spoon for sponsoring the podcast.
And now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, Comings and Goings. And, all right, I'm not going to lie to you, we're stretching it a bit today.
Stretch. But you're going to love it anyway. Because the first coming and going is that Acting Attorney General Monty Wilkinson has now been appointed as the Director of the Executive Office for U.S. Attorneys. Wilkinson was appointed to fill the vacancy left by Bill Barr.
Hey, oh, that's a big goodbye to you. That will never get old, wishing Bill Barr goodbye. Anyway, I interrupted.
Bye. Bye. No, it's totally cool. And while Merrick Garland awaited confirmation by the Senate, and under the rules of the Federal Vacancy Reform Act, you cannot be nominated to permanently serve in a position where you've been an acting head. So he heads over to the EOUSA. What is that, really, honestly? Tell
yeah,
me.
It's
Yowza.
It's a little bit behind the scenes as opposed to, you know, being acting attorney general. But it really does serve two important functions. So first, it's the liaison located in D.C., between the Department of Justice and the 94 separate U.S. attorneys' offices, right? So it is the point of contact and coordination. And second, EOUSA runs a number of really important programs. I mean, important to us, not important to the previous guy, including victims programs, responding to FOIA requests, which presumably this DOJ will do, and also the Equal Employment Opportunity and Diversity Management Program. So, you know, important stuff.
Ah, and both goodbye and hello to Monty Wilkinson, then, who heads back to the EOUSA, where he was director from 2014 to 2017, and previously had served in a number of roles within that office. So aloha, aloha.
Yeah. Hello, goodbye.
Mm-hmm. And finally, someone to whom I hope we never have to say goodbye. I mean, only because of the entertainment value. Sidney Powell.
You know, I yearn for the good old days where I could confidently call Larry Klayman America's dumbest lawyer. Good times.
Good times. So Sidney Powell has been sued by Dominion, as we know, for defamation because she defamed the shit out of Dominion. Yeah. And today, she filed a little court document to move to dismiss the lawsuit because, actually, I'm not sure why she moved to dismiss the lawsuit, but it's having looked it over though just now as I'm going through this, it's fucking hilarious.
It's pretty great, right? So here are the arguments that Sidney Powell are making, right? In order, right? So first, she's argued that the DC court lacks personal jurisdiction over her. Okay. Let me just briefly. To lack personal jurisdiction over someone is to say that they do not have sufficient minimum contacts with the jurisdiction, such as to have submitted themselves to the laws of that jurisdiction. And Sidney Powell was the lawyer for the president, who, I might remind her, lives in the District of Columbia. So, yeah, and she goes on Fox News all the time, right? Like, yeah. I almost feel bad for her lawyers to have to make this argument, except that her lawyers are Howard Kleinhandler and grifter hanger-on Jesse Benal. So I don't. But yeah, so argument number one, what, Sidney Powell and the District of Columbia? Like,
no.
when has she been to this foreign, faraway land? That argument's going nowhere. The backup argument is that the case should be transferred, right? Not that there's anything wrong with the case, but that it should be transferred to the Northern District of Texas. And as far as I can tell, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because she has way more work in Texas.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why not? That's the connections between her efforts to defame Dominion and... it's because... that court would be way more conservative than the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, right? And then finally, the last half is devoted sort of to an argument that...
It's so hard to pick apart her court filings.
It really is. Like,
okay, so I think what's happening here is words, and I'm not sure reasons. The end. Yeah.
Yeah. So, look... Dominion has very clearly stated a cause of action for defamation against Sidney Powell, as you put it, right? So she needs to argue that they haven't really alleged defamation as a matter of law. And part of what you do to sort of set that up, that is true, is, you know, you establish the relevant legal standards. She claims that Dominion is a public figure, and I don't know that. I mean, to me, that seems like a closer call than you would think. But my guess is that Dominion is just going to concede to that, right? Like, the facts are so strong that she's just made stuff up that meets the New York Times v. Sullivan standard, right?
Yeah, totally. If they were a public figure.
Yeah.
Okay, like, they basically, Dominion would be like, all right, let's say that we were. You still are fucking wrong.
Yeah, that's right. And in its lawsuit, Dominion has alleged... that Sidney Powell and that the other defendants, right, Rudy Giuliani and the MyPillow guy and whatever, that they committed actual malice, right? And actual malice does not mean literally actual and malice, right? It does not mean you have to hate us. It means you either have to have knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth. And Sidney Powell has reckless disregard for the truth. So... now she's left trying to explain in this court filing how she said all the things that she said, but they don't legally add up to defamation.
Yep. And this is my favorite part.
It should be.
This is by far my favorite part. Quote, analyzed under these factors and even assuming, arguendo, that each of the statements alleged in this complaint could be proved true or false, no reasonable person would conclude that the statements were truly statements of fact. The statements at issue fit precisely in this mold. They all concern the 2020 presidential election, which was both bitter and controversial. And then, there's this, as if to say, no one reasonable should believe any fucking thing I say. Then she goes on to say, reasonable people understand that language, the language of the political arena, like the language used in labor disputes, is often vituperative, abusive, and inexact. It is likewise a well-recognized, unhyphenated principle that political statements are inherently prone to exaggeration and hyperbole. Now, so she's just saying, yeah, no, I lied my face off in the things. And so you can't reasonably, and this is true for any defamation case. I remember when the former guy sued Bill Maher for saying he was descended from orangutans. And the court said, no reasonable person would believe that Bill Maher actually meant that you were descended from orangutans. You lose. And Fox News has won a few lawsuits on this, with Tucker Carlson most recently, where he was sued for defamation. And they said, Tucker, no one should reasonably believe anything that comes out of Tucker Carlson's mouth. But these aren't lawyers making court filings, right? Aren't there rules 9B or 11 or some sort of court rules that say you can't put exaggeration and hyperbole or lies that reasonable people wouldn't believe in a court document? This seems like she lied in her court filing.
Yeah, so yes and no.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
You knew I was going to say that, because that's what I always say. But here's the thing, right? So the standard playbook when you get sued for defamation is to say you can't prove a key element of defamation against me because you cannot prove that the statement or statements that I made were false, right? And so this is why, for example, I advise some of my clients that pick apart Christian movies for a living, that if you want to call David A.R. White an ass clown, go right ahead, right? Because you cannot, right? Like, who's to say, right? He can say, I strongly contest that I am not an ass clown, but like, the dude's an ass clown, right?
Yeah, like, but I think like making a statement that Dominion worked with Venezuela to change votes or whatever is not an opinion.
Absolutely correct. And so what this misses, and when I say misses, I mean it is bad lawyering for
Tim Tebow misses it, like,
yeah, right. Exactly. On a level that would get you, you know, a C minus if you were taking a torts class, right? Like, is that saying something is a statement of fact for purposes of a motion to dismiss a defamation claim is to say that a statement either can or cannot be proven true or false, right? And their argument seems to be it wasn't a statement of fact because she was talking about a case that she wanted to litigate. And when you go to litigate, like, you know, you're waiting for a court to decide whether that's true or false, right?
Oh, for God's sake.
It's a truly bizarre and stupid argument, because at core here, I mean, we broke down.
I was going to file a lawsuit that the square root of, 81 is 8.
Yeah.
It hasn't been litigated yet.
Is not a statement of fact. That is
right.
That is what their argument is, and I'm going to read it to you, right? Like, in their filings, they say, right, that Sidney Powell, such characterizations, right, of the allegedly defamatory statements, as let me actually take a step back, right? So, after all of the vituperative, abusive, and inexact, the court goes on to say, or Sidney Powell's lawyers go on to say, given the highly charged and political context of the statements, it is clear that Powell was describing the facts, oops, on which she based the lawsuits she filed in support of President Trump. Indeed, plaintiffs themselves characterized the statements as wild accusations and outlandish. They're repeatedly labeled as inherently improbable. Such characterizations further support Sidney Powell's position that reasonable people would not accept such statements as fact, but view them only as claims that await testing by the courts through the adversary process. That's not a thing. Right?
Of course it's not a thing.
It is, again, it just breaks down very, very seriously. If I say AG murdered 6 people in an alley, right? That's a statement of fact, right? Whether it's true or not, right? Because it can be proven true or false. That would provide, if false.
I think she just literally doesn't understand what the term statement of fact means. I think when she hears statement of fact, that it has to be true, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
A statement of fact does not have to be true.
Well, if the statement of fact were true, then there would be no defamation case, right?
Like, right.
It has to be a statement of fact that is in fact false.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, news stations will put, you know, like, alleged murderer in front of murderer, right?
Right.
And that's not because the words are magic, right? It is because you are now accurately describing a statement of fact, and you're covered no matter which way the jury turns out, right? But you would never say, I'm calling you a murderer, right? I called, and again, let's use like Norm MacDonald on Saturday Night Live, called O.J. Simpson a murderer 11 million times.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And that didn't make it less of a statement of fact when OJ was acquitted. It didn't make it not a statement of fact because the trial was pending. It was the fact that the trial was pending that made it a statement of fact in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And this argument is just, it is bonkers, and then inserted in the middle of the kind of arguments you make when your client has called somebody an ass clown, right? Which again, right? If Sidney Powell had said Dominion is, you know, a nasty poo-poo company that does bad stuff, she'd be fine.
Right. But to say that they conspired with Venezuela to overturn the election.
Exactly. So this is truly the gift that keeps on giving. And I do not think it will result in the last answer to your question is lawyers are required assert and attest under Rule 11 that the pleadings they file are true and correct to the best of their knowledge and based on either the law or a good faith basis to extend the law. I don't think that this means that she's subject to Rule 11 sanctions in those existing cases. But those existing cases are so bad that she's been subject to potential sanctions in them already for frivolousness. So, yeah.
Yeah, right. Totally. Well, we will keep an eye on this for you as it heats up, which I'm sure it will. There'll be some sort. There's got to be some sort of settlement here coming. We don't know. We'll figure it out. We'll keep an eye on it and bring it to you. Andrew, before we get out of here, I do have another hello.
Ooh.
Labor Secretary. We have one. Oh. Marty Walsh. He's been confirmed.
Outstanding. That happened. That news broke while we were recording. So.
Yep. And now I can say all 15 cabinet level executive positions are confirmed.
Outstanding.
Woohoo. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Welcome aboard. Yeah, that leaves, I mean, even kind of the next level down, that only leaves one or two open positions. So,
yeah,
I'm very excited.
Now we just got to get onto those U.S. attorneys, inspectors general, all those good ones.
We said there's going to be a lot of work to clean up on aisle 45, but
as Maddo says, it's going to be clean up on aisle 45 for a long time.
Indeed.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Thanks to our patrons. Thanks. I'm looking forward to trivia. We're going to smash it.
Yeah, of course.
And looking forward to see what you guys come up with as team names as well, because that's really my favorite part. This is why I do this. Any final thoughts before we get out of here?
Nope.
All right, everybody, we will see you next week on Cleanup on Aisle 45. Cleanup on Aisle 45 is written and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres and is engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell and Starburns Audio. Fact-checking and research by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres with quality assurance and media by Muller She Wrote LLC. Branding, design, and logo by Starburns Audio and Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. And our copy is written by Jesse Egan. Our music is written and recorded by Adam Orr and Christopher Hoffey, and our opening sequence was designed by Allison Gill and mixed by Mackenzie Mazzell and Starburns Audio. Follow us on Twitter at Aisle 45 Pod and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Don't miss our cleanup on Aisle 45 after party over on the Stereo app. We'll be going live every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 Eastern, and we want to hear from you. Our first stereo show went a little bit like this.
These big corporations are donating money to politicians that are trying to suppress the vote. And that public pressure got them to come out and go, we oppose this, right? So your voice does matter. People just like you have made a difference. And I love, you're going to hear this on tomorrow's cleanup, but Allison has a spectacular analogy that I'm not going to spoil on tonight's Q&A, involving the fact that these Republican efforts target Republicans as well, right? And so it's so good, and I don't want to spoil it. But their thought process is, yeah, we don't care if we, wind up suppressing some Republican votes because we're suppressing more Democratic votes. And that gives you an opportunity to build coalitions with people who care about having their voices. Can you build a coalition with Uncle Frank? No, you can't. But there are a lot of working class pro-Trump people who are like, yeah, you know what? I'd kind of like to be able to vote on the weekend because, you know, I work second shift. And otherwise, like, voting in person on a Tuesday sucks, right?
Yeah.
Lots of opportunities like that. So I hear you. Don't put aside the despair and focus on the positive. And hopefully we've given you some concrete options there.
Stereo app is live social conversations, and they're awesome. And we want to talk directly with you, our listeners. So you can join our show, ask questions about news, politics, or anything. And you can share your experiences and opinions. We want to hear it all. So download now and join us live this week. Link to our show in the description. And join us over on the Stereo app.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond, plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you struggling to lower your bad LDL cholesterol, even though you may be taking a statin, swapping steaks for salads, and exercising while listening to this podcast? Ask your doctor if Repatha Evolocumab is right for you. With Repatha, you can dramatically reduce bad cholesterol and the risk of another heart attack while enjoying life too, because you're human. And with convenient self-administration, you can take Repatha in the comfort of your own home. Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Repatha can cause serious allergic reactions. Signs include trouble breathing or swallowing, or swelling of the face. Most common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. Visit Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA. Talk to your doctor today about Repatha.